there's this Gen AI, which everybody's talking about. But I think the stuff that's most valuable to our community is going to be utility AI, the AI that actually makes the work that we do in real life a little easier.
Welcome to VP Land, the podcast where we explore how making media is getting faster, easier, and less expensive to create, from virtual production to AI and everything in between. I am Joey Dowd, your host. You just heard from Michael Cioni, CEO of Strata. Strata is a new AI-powered cloud platform aimed at speeding up post-production workflows. Michael is no stranger to reinventing workflows, from his first startup, LightIron, to overseeing Frame.io's camera-to-cloud technology. In this wide-ranging conversation that we have, we explore what a 100% cloud-based workflow looks like.
So it's really about a workflow acceleration technique. Over time, we're all going to be working in the cloud exclusively, so we want to be that brand and that product that helps people get there.
How Strata is rethinking how we think about assets when making movies.
And sometimes we just think of each asset as a one-dimensional thing, but it's really three-dimensional.
And we'll revisit our conversation from NAB 2023 and how Michael's views on AI have shifted since then.
This is going to be a bloodbath, was a word that we used, right? This idea that AI is not going to just unilaterally eliminate creative jobs. It's not that simple.
Plus, we've got a little bit of an exclusive preview of what's coming in Strata's private beta launch.
I'll tell you something I haven't told anybody yet as sort of a preview.
Links for everything we talk about are available in the YouTube description or in the podcast show notes. And be sure to subscribe to the VP Land newsletter to stay updated of all of the tech that is changing the way we are making movies. Just go to vp-land.com. And now enjoy my conversation with Michael Cioni. Well, hello, Michael. Good to see you. Thanks for joining. Excited to talk about Strata. But first off, can you just tell me about your two definitions of AI?
Oh, my two definitions are, there's this Gen AI, which everybody's talking about. It creates photos, it creates videos, Runway, Midjourney, DALL-E, super cool stuff. But I think the stuff that's most valuable to our community is going to be the AI that actually makes the work that we do in real life a little easier. And so my focus is on AI that is a utilitarian nature. And I think when it comes to creating, if you want to create in real life, you'll always do that. So Gen AI has its place, but it's really not for me in most cases.
So going with this utility AI, I feel like that feeds into what you're doing with Strata. So can you just give me the high-level overview of Strata, and then we got a lot to dive into on everything that you're doing?
Yeah, Strata is a AI-powered cloud platform that allows people to use AI models that are in the market and concatenate them together, which is a big ugly word for like stitch together multiple models. And then you could process in the cloud and you can get the cloud to do these automations for you. So it's really about a workflow acceleration technique. And over time, we're all going to be working in the cloud exclusively. So we want to be that brand and that product that helps people get there.
I don't think I've ever heard the word concatenate used outside of an Excel formula. So that's it's a very good formula.
That's right.
So let's dive into just sort of like a bit how this looks. And I know you've got the four T's, which is what you're rolling out with as your foundation. So can you list out the four T's and then we could jump into each one at a time. And I kind of got some like more follow-up questions for each one, but let's start with the four T's overview.
Yeah, what's important for people to understand is when you're starting a new product, you have all these challenges. We have these grandiose ideas. Like, let's not talk about Strata for 1 second. If you're an entrepreneur, you're a filmmaker, you're creative, you want to do and create something, you have like the moment where you feel like you're finishing, you're crossing the finish line and everybody's cheering. And you know what that is in your head. But of course, nobody sees getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and practicing and doing all your rehearsals and stuff like that. Nobody sees that. That's the dirty, ugly part of what really success is built on. So for us at Strata, we had to really focus on the foundational aspects before we could get to the really juicy, exciting, groundbreaking stuff. And what we realized, and it sounds kind of basic, but I think it's actually pretty novel. There are four things that every market segment needs, whether you're narrative or nonfiction or sports or news, journalism, whatever you are. We all have trouble transferring files. This whole drive shuttle thing is just not really good. It's just a mess, right? Then we all have trouble transcoding. And most of the problems with transcoding is when you're transcoding, whether it's you or someone else, you get locked out of your product. You're kind of like, I gotta wait till this is over. Maybe that's only an hour. Maybe that's overnight. Who knows? But there's this transcoding hiccup, which includes syncing sound for a lot of us. And then you have to transcribe. And I think we only transcribe in the nonfiction space. And I think transcription in narrative is going to unlock a lot because it's the best search tool. Because you can just search by the language people say, even if that's a narrative. And so that's a big thing. And then the last one is what we call tag or analyze. And we combine that to the word tantalize. And what that means is we can use AI to do object detection, facial emotional detection, location detection, even shot composition detection. What's a medium? Give me a medium shot of Robert De Niro in the kitchen. If you just type that out, because that's how your brain thinks, as opposed to knowing that scene 12 and the close-ups were 12 delta. That's harder to find, and it gets slower, right? But if you say De Niro, kitchen, close-up, boom, and now they're all there, and they're already synced. And so the idea of transfer, transcode, translate or transcribe, and then tantalize is something that we think everyone can use a boost on. And if we could build that at the foundational level of Strata, we can help people get value quickly by using cloud enablers, accelerators, and then we can start building all the crazy AI stuff that will make things a lot better in the future.
I mean, the first version, it's sort of these, I know you're not calling it a digital asset manager, but in that realm where it's like a central spot where you can manage store, well, store-ish, I guess we could talk about the transfer. First off, what kind of storage and stuff are you rolling out with, and what's the idea behind the storage?
That's a great question, because you said this digital asset manager or a media asset manager or an asset manager. So are they DAMs, MAMs, AMs? There's the first part of the problem. Who knows? Who knows what they're called, right? Second of all, what these asset management systems are at their core is robust, tight organization. That's what they're about. I don't think I'm alone. When you're a very left, you know, a very like left-handed, right-brained person, the last thing you want to do is be like constricted to these rules and be super organized. It doesn't come naturally to us. When we're in the most creative of the creative process, we make a mess. And I think these asset management systems are actually designed for non-creative people. They're good for maybe archiving and organizing things when things are done. But during the active workspace of creating, they're a mess. They're restrictive. They make you have to...
I feel like they're built by engineers because they
are.
Were in a lot of cases, yes.
Yeah. So we are not building an asset manager. I don't like asset managers because I don't have the patience when I'm creating to follow the rules. And I'd rather do everything. When I'm creating, my house is a mess. My mixing room, there's cables everywhere. When I'm editing, my desktop is insane and I got cables all over the table. But that's okay. That's what it's like because we're creating. Then when it's done, I want to bring someone else in to vacuum and sweep and all that stuff. That's where the asset managers come in. So what Strata does is it allows us to give people the ability to have the asset management value of instant search and quick response to questions of where things are without having to follow any rules because we've analyzed everything. We've analyzed the language. We've analyzed the visuals. We know the slates. We know the scenes. We know the clips. So you could search by anything. We even know the perspectives. And what a perspective is, if you shoot a camera, but you're also shooting a B camera, we know there's a B when you find A. If there's A and B and then there's audio, we know where the audio is even when you look for A camera. If there's a BTS photographer or BTS videographer, we know where that stuff is too because those are all perspectives of the same instance in time. And sometimes we just think of each asset as a one-dimensional thing or maybe two-dimensional with like picture and sound, but it's really three-dimensional because there's LUTs, there's script notes, there's CDLs, there's BTS. Those are all additional dimensions of perspective. And that's what we're trying to do is associate those together, and we call them Strata stacks. And it's like a sandwich. And your stack is just sandwiching together all the perspectives of that aspect, of that moment in time. So when you find one, you can find them all. And you can use advanced AI search, which is basically like imagine Googling your own movie or your own TV show, your own news story. That's actually what you want to be able to do because we are all good at Google. We all are satisfied with the results and we all know how to use it. But when it comes to finding our needles in haystacks, we don't really have a good way to do that in today's world. And we're going to fix that.
Well, I feel like it's something that we are sort of used to on the consumer level, Apple photos, you know, now you could just search for, show me, you know, pictures of a dog, my dog. You tag someone that you know, and it's like, hey, show me all the photos of, you know, Rebecca. We've gotten used to that on the consumer end, but we haven't really had anything in the professional end that is as seamless as that. I've seen some attempts and stuff, but it's just been a little clunky. Jumping around a little bit, one thing I did like a lot in the demo and going into Transcribe was, I think Austin was like, oh, if you label the person once, we remember who they are. So when they're in other video files, and that is an issue I've run into again and again with like even just the programs where their entire job is to just transcribe, and I have to add the same person's name over and over again. And it's like, why don't you remember? You know their voice. The stuff we just talked about, is this is already going to be in the first version.
Yeah, the private beta. So the private beta is our way to start. I would love to give this to everyone that signed up, which is a huge number, but we can't. We need to roll it out in phases because we need to load test the system because we've never hit it with, you know, several thousand renders at once. We haven't hit that yet. And the only way to do that, it's hard to simulate. You got to just get people to hit it, you know? So we're going to roll it out starting February 1st. And if people are interested, they could sign up and we could talk about getting in the private beta. And we'll just roll it out to make sure our load testing works so we can expand the amount of servers required to keep the load even. But you're right about being able to use like the consumer technology is really, really advanced. And then we go to the pro technology. That's not a new thing. And it's always bothered me because about 10 years ago, maybe 10, 12 years ago, I used to give these presentations mainly at Reducation, which was the Red Camera Company's like education branch. And they were always forward thinking. They were always pushing the boundaries. But all these people would come in to learn how to use Red cameras because 10, 12 years ago, it was pretty uncommon still. Digital was still pretty uncommon. We would speak and I had this slide and I showed the quality of media when you consume it. And on the low end, it was the internet. In the middle, it was television. And the high end was cinema. And that is what 12 years ago, people said the highest quality content was in the movies in terms of the quality of the image. Middle was television. The low end, which was like 720p, was the web. And I said, here's what's going to happen. My prediction 12 years ago was slots 1 and 3 were going to transpose. And what would happen was television would stay in the middle and the internet would improve in quality and cinema would be lower quality than television. And that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. The consumer technologies of the internet coupled with television actually accelerated, and the professionals who were so gung-ho on like blocking innovation and making sure it met all these crazy specs of luminance values and all this stuff with DLP projections, and I was like, you guys are going to stifle this and you're going to regulate yourselves below the quality threshold. And that's exactly what happened. Right now, when you go to the cinema, I'm not saying the images aren't shot well, and I'm not saying projectors aren't good, but you get a better picture at home on a 75-inch LG streaming from the internet than you do in a theater. And someone out there is going to challenge me on that, but go ahead.
I've experienced this, yeah, going back to the theaters and stuff. I've like, I'll throw them under the bus, sort of iPic, you know, where they sort of like brand themselves. It's like, yes, you know, better projection. And like both times, it's either been a subpar sound experience or a subpar, like even just the masking on the projector was off and, you know, stuff's bleeding onto the black. And it was just like, this is supposed to be, you know, I'm paying the premium to like get the supreme experience, but I can just pop in headphones and watch it on my TV at a much better quality.
Well, not to mention, well, there's always a marquee opportunity with a laser projector on a great screen that's well curated. The average person is not seeing 4K. They're not seeing laser. They're not seeing more than 2,000:1 contrast ratio, where we're able to see more than 1,000,000:1 at home. The brightest image on a projector is often like 20 lumens, you know, and we could get, you know, 10 times that at home now. The criticism is not of the work or the shows or the stories. The criticism is of the opportunity and the technology. And so what I'm saying is sometimes the consumer market runs away, and because of competition, they're able to like explore these new avenues. And so that's why Apple, you mentioned, and this happens on Galaxy and Pixel as well, but you can search your photos, you can find things because it's AI tagged automatically in the background. And the reason that is they're innovating that way. They realize there's a value. This is interesting. They learned that nobody makes folders on their phones. The folder technology has been there for many, many, many years, but nobody creates a new folder and curates their own albums. So they said, well, how do people find things if they're not going to create folders? And so what you're actually doing when you're searching is searching virtual folders. Because when you search dog, it's creating a folder in a way. You just didn't make it. You can't see it, but it gives you the essence of a virtual folder. The reason that doesn't exist in the pro space for, you know, Avid and Final Cut and Premiere and Resolve and Pro Tools and Nuendo is because those are not cloud applications. So it's hard for them. They're not even also online. Like, they're not always aware of the internet. And so they can't leverage a lot of this technology. And so it's not being built that way. You have to have a cloud system. You have to be online all the time for things like this to materialize. So Strata will act like your iPhone. You can search by dog and it'll show you a picture of a dog. It'll show you a dog barking because it knows what a dog sounds like. And then if someone says the word dog, it'll bring up the video of them being interviewed talking about dogs. And then you have a virtual folder of dogs. And that type of speed is going to really change how everyone's going to want to start to edit and produce and write.
Going to where the media is stored and stuff, and I sort of threw this in at the end of one of the other questions, because you are not providing storage. It is bring your own storage. So walk me through, like, what are some of the initial storage options and where you see that going in the future?
Yeah, I'll answer that. And I'll tell you something I haven't told anybody yet as sort of a preview. So first of all, we all have cloud subscriptions and all of us have subscription fatigue. And so what I didn't want to do is invent a new product that required more sub fatigue. So we're allowing you to bring your own existing storage. That storage has to abide by a certain type of technological rule, which is called OAuth. But if they support OAuth with a REST API, we're able to connect to that. So Strata can do things on existing storage like Dropbox or Google Drive or Frame.io that maybe those products don't do, or Lightroom even. So if you want to leverage some of our search or some of our transcoding or some of our AI analysis, you could do that even though Dropbox may not have the same function. And so you don't pay any more for storage because you're already paying for it. There's not even an egress charge. So you're just using, because it's just reading off your own storage. So that's important to me, that we make this a low barrier to entry so people could just connect storage. Plus, if you are good at managing your own clouds, then you know where your stuff is. And so Strata just looks familiar because you're like, oh, these are my directories and I could do that. But I want to take it a step further. And what we haven't told anyone, and we'll talk about this more in the future, but what I haven't told anyone is we also don't want the cloud to be a barrier to entry at all. Meaning some people cannot afford to store their assets in the cloud. They just don't have the money to do that, because once you're putting assets in the cloud, you pay that forever, 20, 30 years. Most of us don't think about that. When we first signed up for email, depending on what age you were, you probably didn't realize you'd have this email address for decades and decades and decades.
That's
which
be
is
your
why
identity. Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't know that. That's why a lot of us, our first email address was like some guy in the front yard at Hotmail.
Hotmail.co, yeah.
We didn't just say it's just
2 megabytes. You know, then you can switch to Yahoo and get the whopping 4 megabytes.
Yeah. We didn't think it through. But now people are starting to realize, wow, when I have a cloud subscription, it's forever. So that sounds expensive. It's like worse than a mortgage because you don't ever pay it off. So it's like, oh my gosh, a fixed expense that doesn't come down on principal. Like, what?
It's only going to go up as you keep adding more media.
Yeah. So what I want to do is make sure that we give people an additional alternative, because I'm willing to bet everybody, at least listening to this, has a closet somewhere where there's lots and lots of old drives. Some of them work, some of them probably don't, but we have this closet of drives. We're not going to throw them away, so what are you going to do with them? I also think people also have an extra computer or two, an old laptop, an old tower, whatever it is. And you used to make it your primary, then it became your secondary, and now maybe it's in the closet. Well, what if there was a technology with an orchestration layer called Strata, and Strata could put those machines or those drives online, and you actually made your own cloud? Because if you are connected to the internet on an old computer and you put your drives there, what is a cloud? A cloud is a drive on the internet. That's all it is. So why does it have to be Amazon's or Azure's or Google's or Apple's? It doesn't. It doesn't. Obviously, there are major advantages for enterprise level clouds, but if all you need is an internet connection and a hard drive, what if we could make that work for you? Imagine you're being a photographer and you do a shoot and you have your photo retoucher, and all you do is download your photos to your drive, which you do anyway, and your drive is connected into Strata, and your retoucher can pull files off your drive using your internet, and there's no cloud used at all. That's a democratized future. And that's the type of thing that we're starting to build that should lower the barrier to entry and allow you to make use of things you have today. Then when you need additional acceleration or more capacity or speed, then the cloud is going to outperform your local hard drive. But when you don't need that, why not make use of it? And I think one of the hardest parts about getting into the cloud is getting stuff up to it. We're super aware of that. When I worked at Frame.io, the hardest part is to get assets to the cloud. So we had to make these little proxy files. And what I want to do is make sure that we can generate proxy files even easier for any asset coming off of any technology and make sure that it gets to the cloud. And it can be done on a very poor internet bandwidth so that people could get working regardless of what internet resources they have.
That's awesome. That is exciting to hear too, just from my own personal workflow stuff where I bought a NAS and then learned after the fact where it's like, it's really hard to have people remotely access it without involving the cloud in some way. And it's where it's like, oh, the media's got to go up to an AWS or Backblaze or something before they can pull it. And it is the same paradox where it's just like, well, then why did I buy a NAS if I have to store it in the cloud anyways? So yes, this exactly is very excited to hear. So is this a local application that's running on your desktop or whatever that you on the computer that you're sort of designating as your Strata PC?
Not even because Strata is bring your own storage. When some companies say bring your own storage, they kind of mean like a shallow version. So you got to check, you got to read the fine print. When people say bring your own storage, what do they actually mean by that? When I say it, I'm talking about your own storage like a thumb drive. That's how granular I'm going for your own storage, is turn that into storage. So bring your own storage means you connect it to Strata, the cloud app. So you need an internet connection for it to run the traffic, right? So those are mainly kilobytes. They're not super large to manage the traffic. Now, moving the asset, you need a decent internet connection, decent. But again, you don't need to run a special app. Strata is going to allow you to connect that drive and allow other people to access it.
From the web app, from the web interface.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
On the computer, I can just load up whatever Chrome and plug in my drives and...
That's right. Just like, because
point Strata to it. Yeah.
Yeah, because to me, you don't want there to be a different experience for the user between connecting Dropbox and connecting your Le C drive or your NAS. Like, it shouldn't be any different. And then you just realize that. Now, if you turn your computer off or disconnect your NAS, whoever's reading it, it goes away, just like when AWS goes down, which happens once in a very long while, but it can happen. So people have to understand there's a responsibility for serving assets through the cloud. But I think people can wrap their heads around that and be like, okay, my computer's turned off. That's the end of that asset. And so I'm going to have to reboot. But it'll reconnect just like a drive that is on a computer that turns off. It reconnects and then you're good from there. So, you know, it's a little more advanced than just having a disk locally on your computer, but it's not so much more advanced than having to spin up your own AWS instance, which 99% of the consumer world will never do. And creatives that have teams fewer than 10 almost never do that. And we want them to have the same access that perhaps an Amazon disparate server has for them without the cost. If you've invested in a NAS, why can't you share that NAS across your team? And I'll give you one more about this. If you are on the same network, so let's say you're in an office with a NAS, which a lot of people have. If you're in an office with a NAS, you could connect that NAS through Strata and it will use your LAN to move the assets around. Strata will still be the interface of the orchestration, but the assets will actually move through your routers. So they won't go through the internet. They just use the routers. And if you have Wi-Fi 6 routers, you're going to be able to move those assets on a local area network like a SAN, but you only have a NAS. And for people that know what those two acronyms are different, that's a big breakthrough and a very, very powerful workflow advantage.
So people working locally in the same office with the NAS are going to be able to access the media off there. It's not have to go up to the internet and come back down. They could just pull it as if they're wired right into the NAS to work off that media.
Yeah, that's not going to be in the beta. It's not going to be in the beta. But those are the things we're working on because, again, the beta, the four T's, is all about foundational. We need to get a foundation going so people need the product and use it. And then we'll start putting in these workflow accelerators. I've been working in post-production since I was 18 years old. I got a job at PBS, at a PBS station called WSIU at 18. I started working at post. I didn't even know what post was. And so for 25 years, I've been in post-production. And I became a workaholic way back then at 18 because I just fell in love and just got so excited. And I haven't slept since. And so across that world, when I started, I was on 1-inch tape machines, VPR 80, Ampex 1-inch tape machine. And I learned Beta and then Digibeta and then DVCam. And then we moved to P2 with Panasonic, then Redfiles and on and on. And throughout each of those, I watched these transitions happen and I kept running into these brick walls because I was an early adopter in every single one of these technologies. And in those technologies, I just wanted to use workflow knowledge to make it a little bit easier and better. And that always gave me an accelerant. It always gave me an advantage compared to other people in the space. And so I was able to move faster. I want those advantages to go back into being able to be distributed at a larger level. I've always tried to be transparent. When we built Light Iron, we put out a lot of like how-tos all the time. And I showed people, you know, what's going on behind the curtain. And I was very transparent about that. I hate the idea that post houses have called secret sauce. I couldn't stand that. Because every time I learned what the secret sauce was, I'm like, this is a lie. It's not even sauce. it's just like they
someone
switched
the night shift or something.
It really seemed like, yeah, like this is our automated VFX pull list, and it would print out a job and someone would read it and do it and then print it back. I mean, oh, we switched the Phillips head screws for flat head screws. That's our custom. I mean, come on. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I didn't like the idea of secret sauce. I thought it's a better world if we could be transparent. And 19 out of 20 people that you tell them how to cook a great meal are still going to pay you to cook it for them, right? Because they're like, well, you're an expert. I'd rather go to your restaurant and have you cook it, even though you gave me the cookbook, right? And then there's that 1 out of 20 that says, oh, thanks for this. I'm going to do it myself. Okay, fine. But 19 others become fans, right? And they respond to the transparency. And so what Strata is the ultimate version of me being able to take the workflows that I've learned and pioneered and try to make them even better and make them unilaterally available, where something like a fingerprint ID is going to give you access to them. And hopefully we're building a tool simple enough that it's not built for editors. It's built for everyone, writers, producers, directors, post soups, VFX soups, certainly editors. But we're trying to make a tool that doesn't require you to need to go to YouTube and learn how to use it before you can figure out how to take advantage of it.
Yeah. And I do want to just jump into some more of the use cases, but I had a specific question that came up, and now it's even more relevant that you just told me that you're going to be able to connect any hard drive you want to Strata. But a frequent case is like, okay, you have your media, you copy it to your hard drive, your two hard drives, and then you copy it to maybe you copied some stuff to Google Drive, and then you copied it to another hard drive that you're working off of. If you have the same file, is there some sort of checksum or something when the stuff gets indexed by Strata where it would be like, oh, hey, we realize that these are the same exact files, and so we're not going to like create duplicate assets?
Yeah, the good news is when you go to cloud storage, checksums are part of that process. And so they're not surfaced the same way that we do when we like do on set, but they all have an XX hash associated with the with the UUID. So that becomes kind of invisible in a way. However, because Strata today isn't a storage itself, it only reads what you've already uploaded to it. So you have to get it there in your Dropbox or your Google Drive or whatever, because you can't upload it. You're not really like uploading into Strata. You know, that's to your advantage right now because it saves you money, but you've got to upload it to Google and it has to be there on the Google side before Strata can read it.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is like if I had the same file on my Google Drive and I had it on a hard drive that was connected to Strata, would it realize, these are the same files and not be like, here's two different assets? Or
absolutely.
Or would it be like, hey, this is one asset and it's stored in your Google Drive and it's stored on your Lacey Drive?
I see what you mean. Yes. Sorry about that. Going back to the idea of Strata stacks, a stack can actually be a duplicate of the same asset, right? Or if you shot a ProRes file and you have that as the original on your drive and then you put it into Google Drive, then you have two ProRes files. Well, those just go in the same stack and it shows you, well, one is located here and the other is located there. Great. Now, if you took that ProRes and converted it into an H.265, even though it's not a ProRes, it's the same thing happening again. So it's like, here's the HEVC, here's a ProRes located here, here's a ProRes located there. Again, that's another perspective. The version on a local drive versus a cloud drive is just another perspective. And that's why the stacks keeps track of all that. To ensure it's a really clever, this orchestration layer is very clever. Most review and approval tools, I would say almost none, have an orchestration layer. This is one of like the secret things about Strata that we built. This really
is like the timeline kind of view of like pairing up. Like I've seen some of these like kind of like timeline previews in your videos where it's like pairing up the ACAM and BCAM and BTS photos like in a synchronized view. That's the orchestration view.
That's how we display it so you can see it. But the orchestration view, think of it more like the air traffic controllers running an airport. You never see those people. You know there's a tower somewhere on the property and they're doing all this stuff, but they're invisible. But their jobs are really important to make sure nothing runs into each other. That's what the orchestration layer does. And then it just surfaces it, again, with an airport analogy, on the board, and you see this is the gate, this is the terminal, and this is the time it's leaving. All that stuff is what's ultimately shared.
All right, real quick, if you are enjoying my conversation with Michael, then you will enjoy the VP Land newsletter. It is a twice weekly newsletter where we cover all sorts of news and updates in the latest technology that is changing the way we are making movies, from the latest virtual production updates, the latest AI stuff that relates to making movies, not just all sorts of AI stuff. Stuff that matters to you, and all sorts of stuff in between, behind the scenes, episodes, videos, interviews, stuff like that. So if that sounds interesting, be sure to subscribe. You go to vp-land.com, or the link will be in the description on YouTube or in the show notes, wherever you are listening or watching this. All right, now back to the episode.
I did want to clarify, or something that was impressive and that you've mentioned, and I know you're still figuring out whatever the sort of model and pricing is, but right now you're saying everything that you do upload is going to get transcribed and tagged/analyzed. So is that still the case? That is very impressive and very cool, because normally it's like, you only got to pay, you know, per minute every time. And then you got to decide, do I transcribe it or do I not? So is that still the case? And, you know, what was the thought behind that?
Yeah. And again, what's so important to us is to lower the barrier to entry. So if you have time and you have equipment, you can elect to do a lot of the processing on your local machine. So for example, if you, let's say you're doing a job and it's a low budge job and it's small enough that you can afford to just do the transcodes yourself, which is how you do it today. You could have Strata still do the Strata technique, but it would pull all the processing on your local drive, your local computer. So it would do all that, even transcode it and then upload it that way. So then you're not incurring any expense for cloud processing of your assets. But let's say you have a job and it's a fast turnaround and you've got more money coming in for the job and you've got a lot more data. Okay, I'm going to have the cloud do the rendering. And so you can elect those variations. And again, it's all about shape shifting. So many of us in the creative world, our jobs change, the scope of the job changes, the size of the team changes, even the season that we work, there's seasons that pay more than other seasons. There's a rhythm to all this stuff. And what I don't like about cloud subscription tools is they either don't know that that's how it works or they don't care. And so they just charge you a flat rate no matter what. And the problem is you might have a product that has 20 users. And in a month where you're really active, that feels really valuable. But when you're in the downtime, or like what we just came out of, you know, the Christmas season, a lot of people don't shoot in December, right? And it's like, I still had to pay for the 20 users and I only had two people, right?
It's a very inactive time, yeah.
It's a very inactive time. And sometimes, you know, the summer, like, you know, in the Northeast, July is kind of people leave town, right? And so it's very common out there. And so it's like when people are traveling, it's a different type of rhythm. So we want to make sure that Strata can allow you to process where you want. And one thing we're not going to be charging for is users. We will not charge for users. Strata will be unlimited users for the main use case. If there are functions that are specific to like a user need, that I reserve the right to explore what that could mean. But in terms of like how many people you can invite into a traditional Strata project, that's unlimited. We make money if you create more content. So I don't want to make money based on how many people it requires for that content to be created. And if it's one person or 100 people, what's the difference? I get paid if you're using the services to move these assets around and transcribe and translate and transcode and stuff like that. So I actually want more people to be on the platform. So I'm not going to make it a penalty to invite them. And what a lot of people do, and I even do this because of the cost of some of the platforms I use, I have to share email addresses and passwords, or people use one like bulk password for a division or a department. That is a risk to security. And we do it to save money. I don't want that to be a Strata tenant. So we're allowing people to have unlimited users So you're not penalized for inviting someone in, and then you don't have to risk security issues or when someone leaves or is let go or moves on to another job, they like could still access the footage. That happens all the time with other platforms. And it's because they're user-based subscriptions. And I think that is wrong for our marketplace.
User seats can become a big issue of like, who do I give a seat to? Who do I not give a seat to? Share a password. And I know you've got a big thing on being able to have your identity, being able to have your virtual identity tied to like one Strata account across multiple email addresses. So then when you do figure out, so is the pricing sort of going to be based on like how much processing or how much media you're like having to do things to? Is that going to end up being where pricing goes of like how this turns out?
Yeah. If you want to use the cloud to enhance or accelerate processing, you're going to pay more for that. And what larger clients that are constantly rendering and moving files may do is reserve a certain amount of computers for them. So if you're a larger client, you could say, I want 50 machines for our account at all times. And then that's going to cost more. But anytime someone on your team hits render, there's 50 machines computing together on that job. Or you could have 50 people rendering at the same time, something like that. And for people that don't want that, they can render locally or just render one machine at a time. And you could sort of govern what your pain tolerance is, right? Another way we make money is if you, once we get the marketplace going where you can start searching for custom AI models, those models, just like the App Store or like Airbnb, we just get a cut as a customer acquisition because we're lowering the customer acquisition cost. The CAC goes down. People can search for, I need noise reduction for traffic, right? Because today there's, every NLE has a noise reduction tool, but it's usually just a slider that's just kind of like more or less. But in the AI space, people will make noise reduction. This is just one example, but they'll make noise reduction for traffic versus crowds versus fan noise versus an audio mic, malfunction, versus music in the background. AI models are going to be able to be trained to do all those ideally for each of those situations versus just unilateral noise reduction, which is always going to be okay, but not perfect depending on the situation. So to do that, Strata allows you to search for auto noise reduction and then say traffic or fan noise or music. And then it will give you that model and you'll be able to find it, test it, try it, then buy it. And then I get a cut when you make that purchase because I've been able to connect a user to that particular model way cheaper than the model having to set up a paywall and a website and an e-commerce system and advertise it. So they won't have to do all that stuff. If they just list on the App Store, just like the App Store works today, none of those companies have to advertise because their search is the advertisement and Apple just brings people or Android to the Google Play Store. It brings people to the store or Airbnb. It brings people to the store and then you can find the app you want, the address you want, the song you want, whatever. In our case, the AI model you want. This type of marketplace has worked in every other market. It works in music. It works in lodging. It works in travel. It works in apps. Why doesn't it work in workflow? I think it could. No one's done it before. It's totally new, but we think that when people are looking for a specific type of thing, there'll be a model designed for that. And if there isn't, the AI model community, they will build it because they'll say, oh, there's a need for that. Okay, then let's make it, right? And so this is the type of thing that's going to get really exciting because we'll be able to connect customers with developers so that we can give them the information on how the model should actually work to serve the creative community better.
So let's dive in a little bit more because I know this is sort of the second part or the other part of like this marketplace and being able to bring in models and use custom workflows for whatever your needs may be. But also to take a step back with just AI, the AI models in general, because I feel like a lot of the attention has been on ChatGPT, OpenAI, and just a lot of the AI tools out there are some sort of wrapper or something around the OpenAI model. But this is more in line with like Hugging Face being a directory of people who built their own AI models using, I believe they disclose what the data sets are, right? And Hugging Face, and is that going to be something similar here on Strata where it's just like a marketplace of people building custom models that solve specific problems?
Yes, and we think the Hugging Face community is the best community to actually build this stuff because the Hugging Face community has the talent and the drive and the experience, but what they don't have is the insight on what to build and how it needs to work because the Hugging Face community doesn't connect with cinematographers and editors very easily. And cinematographers and editors and post supers and visual effects supers and directors, they're not going to know how to navigate through the Huggy Face world to find what they're looking for. Plus, the Hugging Face world is very specific. One of the problems with AI is it is not codec agnostic. It will never be codec agnostic. It is very unlikely that you could take a Sony, you know, XOCN file and run it through an audio AI noise reduction tool. It's very unlikely that will happen. So you have to create a mezzanine format. If you create a mezzanine format, well, does the quality go down? Is that a problem? How do you keep track of that mezzanine, right? Like, it gets really nasty. It gets really hard. And then all of a sudden you're like, this isn't a workflow. This is really just a one-off thing. Maybe I could use it for a one-off problem, but I can't do it in batches. I can't do it with scale. I can't do it with a team. I can't do it securely. I can't do it and manage how much it costs, because I don't want to put my credit card, if I'm working on a movie and use a model, I don't want to give them my credit card, and I don't have Universal's credit card, right? So all of these are problems that the Hugging Face community isn't really dialed into solving. It's not their job. It's not their role. It's not their product. So Strata becomes that, again, it's like that air traffic controller that can connect the passengers to the airlines, connect the users to the models, and be able to do that safely with security, with access, with information. And we should be able to, we should, like, this is all like should, because we, none of this has been done before. So it's theoretical, truly, at this point. This is, what are we, January 2024. This is theoretic, but we believe it makes sense. We know technologically it's possible, because we've done some stuff in-house that proves it. And we think there's a market demand for this, but the market has to be invented. Because before smartphones, there was no proof that people wanted smartphones. Before Airbnb, there was no proof people would want to sleep in someone else's bed. Before Uber, there was no proof that someone would want to get into a stranger's car. But all those barriers were overcome, and there was a discovery that the people actually do want this type of control, this self-serve control that didn't exist prior. And we think that the creative community is no different. It would prefer to have AI models more specific or bespoke to their needs than have to just find sliders and get the best they can get out of that.
And cobbling together whatever tools or whatever is out there.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot. So we talked a lot about working in Strata and sort of what Strata can do. Where do you go from Strata to your NLE, to your Premiere, Resolve, Final Cut? So like, what's the next kind of like, going out of Strata, how does that connect to the other tools that people use?
Right. So that's a really great question, because the simplest way is to use XML and ALE exchange. And so when you have all this work in Strata, you send it to the editor that way. And what Strata will do for editors today is it'll already be synced. It'll already be multicammed. It'll already be tagged. It'll already be transcribed. So you don't have to do those things. I understand how much value there is in transcribing in an NLE, but I think the NLE is the wrong place to transcribe, because what's happening is that the post-production community and the production community is expecting the editors to do the transcription, and it's not their job. Now, if you are the director, cinematographer, editor, colorist, okay, everything's your job, so I'm not talking to you. But if you have departments, you have different people, I don't think it's fair to dump transcription on the cutting room, because they got other problems there, and they need to be cutting, not transcribing. So I think it's important that we transcribe upstream of the cutting room. That way, two benefits. One, you're not taxing the cutting room to produce all that on a daily basis when there's new material. And two, a director or a producer or a story editor doesn't need to know how to use an NLE just to read the transcript. Or three,
or build out a paper edit.
Yeah. Or build out, build out a paper. Or three, they don't have to watch it independent of the video. See, if I say, I'll export an SRT file or a text document. Yeah, but then I can't see it at the same time. Today, you have to have an NLE to see a transcript and see a video and hear the audio altogether, except in Strata. Strata makes these virtual files, right? These Strata stacks, and it'll have the text, the language, the video, the audio, the other cameras, right? And you don't have to render anything because it's happening in virtual space. The picture and sound and the transcript aren't being baked in. They're just there, stapled together, right? Just like a sandwich. A sandwich doesn't become one mass. It's all those layers. You could take it apart if you wanted to, right? Till you eat it. But before you eat it, it's all separatable. And the same thing should be with video. What we've been taught for 50 years is that when you put things together, you then wrap them up and you transcode it, you bake it in, you flatten it, and then you consume it. And that is wrong. That's limiting. And that we have to break that behavior and be like, don't do that. There are still ways that that will certainly be useful. But if I can see and hear, read, transcript, burn in, LUT, change, and I don't have to render anything, then you shouldn't have to. And that's where Strata's virtual stack system should help alleviate some of this stuff. So it's a different way of working. I hope people get it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like things have been shifting in that direction. I mean, us personally, I mean, I've got some videos about it, but we've been using Descript just because sure. It was a good combo of easy to use, transcribes everything, and you can edit the text, and building out rough cuts and stuff in there, and then sending the XML off to, you know, Premiere and stuff. But it's easier to work with clients, and that, all the issues you just listed where it's like, Premiere, like, yeah, I'm not going to try to ask someone to work in that. That's not familiar with it. I know some of your videos I've heard mentions of like paper edit in Strata. Is that going to be in the first version, or is that in the pipeline for being able to build out assemblies and stuff inside Strata before sending it off as an XML?
Yeah, not in the first beta. The private beta will have the ability to see the transcripts, read it, and connect it all to the video, but it will not allow you to do an editing of that yet. So that's on the roadmap for later in 24.
Nice. Now I want to shift a little bit. You've had the YouTube channel going on for a few months, documenting the journey. The first part didn't even explain what Strata was. It was like a hardcore, just like, this is how you do a startup, and talking about like equity and all sorts of stuff where I was like, where's the film stuff? But this was also very fascinating in just the behind the scenes of building the startup. I think this is also maybe a record for the first YouTube channel shot on a Panavision DXL2. I don't know if you have a record for that. And the first time I was getting PR emails too of like, hey, Michael's got a new YouTube video up. You should check it out. So that was, I think, some records. But anyways, I wanted to know, what was the idea behind launching the YouTube channel and sort of documenting this process as you're building Strata?
Yeah, well, you made a funny point at the beginning, is we don't talk about the filmmaking world because we didn't have Strata yet. When we started Strata, we didn't actually know what we were starting. When I was at NAB, actually being interviewed by you was truthfully one of these pivotal moments. I did a lot of interviews back in April of 2023, and I was standing there, and you were one of the people that we had a great conversation with. Mm-hmm. And I bet there's some clues in that interview if we rewatched it, honestly. But I realized when I was looking out at the NAB floor, there was no AI technology there. None, almost none. And I said, wow, 5 years from now, this thing is going to be crawling with AI. And I looked at brands, I'm not going to say them, but I looked at brands, I'm like, AI could replace them. AI could replace them. AI could replace them. Whoa, this is going to be a bloodbath, was a word that we used, right? And we said, this is going to be very scary because there's going to be a massive transformation. And some of the companies that I'm sort of pointing at have been here for decades. These are very, very experienced, long-form companies. I just realized driving back from Vegas, I usually drive to Vegas because often I used to have to fly so much. When I can drive somewhere, I find that L.A. to Vegas,
it is
drive.
A great drive, too. It is a
it's
great drive.
7 a.m. on a Sunday or a Saturday.
Through the desert and the mountains. It's a beautiful
really
drive.
Beautiful. Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah. And when you're by yourself, you could just think. And there's no phones. It's really nice. So on my drive back, I'm like, I think there's going to be a new change. And I want to be – I know there's going to be a change. And I want to be a part of it. And I don't know what it is. I don't know what I could do. I didn't have an idea. But I drove back from NAB – in April of 23, and I just thought, I think I need to start something new in order to discover what that will be. My friend Haley Royal, she told me about this idea. It's a term called build in public. And a few companies have done this, but not many, but a few have done it. And she says, you should build in public. And you just capture what you're doing, and you just share it. And that's just what it is. And each episode is a step. So it started out as just how to start a company. And we talk about websites and investors and how to raise money and how to set things up, how to hire people, how to build job descriptions, really things that film schools are really bad at teaching. They don't teach those things, right?
No.
And everybody wants to get to the lenses and the cables and the I know that. We all want to see that stuff. But really, none of that matters if you can't get a proper budgeting system up, a proper payroll system set up, a proper website stood up, a name that's trademarked. Like, you got to do all that stuff. And right-brained people, again, creative people, are bad at that. It's not a criticism. It's just the truth. I'm bad at it. And so going through it, I wanted to document it to help people understand that being a proper business owner is necessary if you want to really be a great creator. Because the greatest of all creators are great business people. If you find out underneath that, they're great at business. Jim Cameron started Digital Domain, right? Like Lucas started the ILM, right? Like Peter Jackson helped start Weta. Like these are people that are building businesses that are very, very organized inside of their ability to create. Then they can create whatever they want because they have this infrastructure of post-production and workflow and business tied to it. And then that business can do work for other companies, right? And those are just a few examples, but these are all really, really important attributes that I think are missed in the scholastic sense of creatives. And so I wanted to document that. It's also true. Like this is what we were doing. So if you watch the show from stage one, next week is episode 20. So starting with episode one, I quit my job. I was kind of debating, was that a good idea? And then we just worked the problem out. And then we discovered Strata along the way, trying to solve problems and figure out what the problems were. And then an episode coming up will be the launch of the beta. And you can watch the whole thing. I don't know who they are, but someone said like, this is like a Netflix show. And they said they've never seen a Netflix series on YouTube. And they called us that. I don't know if that's, I should take that. I don't think
that's a compliment. I mean, I think it's, you know, nice. You bring the high quality production value to it as well, which makes it feel different. It's interesting you talk about the creator and business thing because I feel like, you know, you're giving examples from the creators at like the pinnacle peak of like Hollywood production and creativity. But I feel like we see the other end now a lot more in creator economy and creator space of people who like make stuff on YouTube and then have success and then realize like I need to build the business aspect around what I'm already doing from the other direction. So yeah, I think that's definitely an important trend that you've been talking about and documenting. And I learned a lot about just startup ecosystem in general and your videos about equity versus salary compensation and just figuring out the balance behind that and building teams.
Yeah, that's what we tried to do. It turns out what I calculated this week is I've written 60,000 words across the series, which is basically a novel. So someday I want to write a book. I kind of wrote one and now I know I can do it because I wrote these scripts. Every Saturday I sit down, I just kind of chronicle what happened this week and I write it. And then on Sundays I record it. And then on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we edit it. And then Thursday, we polish, sound, mix, and then we cut some promos. And then we do it again every week. And it's like a little mini TV show. What's really important to us, the creator of the investment group, Y Combinator, Paul Graham, he has a phrase that we use a lot around here. And he says, it's better to have 100 people love you than 1,000,000 people that like you. We're not after millions of likes. We're after a few people that love it. And we're trying to help people at where they are, meet them where they are and help them. And if we could build a product that people love, a few people that love it is really what we're after. And in our YouTube world, we have some wonderful people that follow us and are using it and giving us the feedback that they're able to actually take this information and use it for themselves to do better work and set themselves up. That is so awesome. It's so exciting that it's actually useful. Because this is the hidden, these are the secrets of business that nobody wants to talk about. Setting up a payroll system, buying a website domain, not only does that sound boring, so I tried my best to make it entertaining, but it's also stuff that nobody even talks about because you just think it's like a box you just check. Oh, get the website you make. Wait, that's like a month of work right there. How do you really pull that off? And I wanted to like tell that story because everybody needs to go through it. And when we told that, everybody came out of the woodwork saying, oh, it's the worst. I can't stand it. GoDaddy's a scam. And people like all had the same experience we did. I had no idea because nobody talked about it. I never knew everybody has the same woes. And so it's like by putting it out there, I learned, oh, everybody's feeling the way I do. Okay, we're not alone here. It's a real nasty part of the business, but we all got to do it.
Can you walk me through, you mentioned in some of your videos, you talked about some of the tools you use. You already mentioned sort of your production schedule, but some of the AI tools you used, some that I hadn't even heard of, and I thought they're very interesting in how you put together some of your archival footage and up-resed various shots and stuff.
Yeah, one of my favorite tools is Rimini. Rimini is owned by the business Bending Spoons. Bending Spoons has great AI tech. They invest in a lot of places. They're really powerful. But Rimini did photo AI enhancement. You wouldn't say sharpening. Topaz is good for sharpening, right? But Rimini actually rebuilds like skin and hair and eyebrows and things like that. My only problem with Rimini is it goes too far. So you usually have to back it off separately. But what it can do automatically is amazing. So I use Rimini now constantly. I have the phone app. I have it on my desktop. And I'm constantly running photos through Rimini. And then what I do is I bring it into Photoshop or sometimes even in Final Cut. And I just mask out the part I really want the advanced part to be in because it over enhances everything. But I use this all the time. And then in the middle of us making the show, Rimini added video. You could start doing a video. Now, the problem is the video advancement they have is short, so you can only do like smaller clips, but you can run small clips through it and it will start to do it in motion. It's slow and it is short, but it gives us video solutions. So we have a way to start doing that. Another tool I use is Evodo. Evodo is like Photoshop retouching, but it doesn't require any training. And if you want to get really good at retouching wrinkles and skin and hair and even wrinkles in shirts versus eyes and stuff, you have to be really good when you're messing with somebody's face. But in Evodo, you do not. Evodo basically takes an image and it carves it up invisibly to like 50 different layers. And those layers are now sliders. And a layer is just like eye wrinkle or smile line or forehead or this. And in Photoshop, you have to carve all those out, label all those layers, and you have to work all your tricks to do that. In Evodo, you do not. Now, if someone says, I can get Photoshop to do better, that's fine. I would say Evodo will take you 80% of the way there with 10% effort. And that's why it's powerful. Not because it can do everything Photoshop can. It can't. But it can get you 80% of the way with a fraction of the effort. And so I run everything through Rimini first, and then I back it off, and then Evodo. And what I'm able to get in like 60 seconds is like what used to take me like 20 minutes. And that's a big difference when you're doing batches. Those are a couple of AI things that I am using pretty much daily. And those subscriptions, I'm consuming a lot. And hopefully they'll be able to be plugged into that concatenation layer in Strata so that you could start doing it in batches across assets in a video workflow, hopefully.
Right. Yeah. You're describing the, sort of the round tripping you were doing and building out these things was sort of like the lead into this is what you're trying to solve with Strata, where you can just do it all inside the platform before going and having to round trip it back and forth to Final Cut. And another interesting one that you had talked about was the E-Mastered, where you were mixing, sending out your final audio mix. That one I hadn't heard of, and you were just throwing your entire YouTube mix to E-Mastered and letting it just mix your levels.
Yeah, like I've been using E-Mastered for years. It was way ahead of this AI train that we see in the zeitgeist today. E-Mastered's been around for many years. It's just a model that allows you to upload a pre-mix and it'll mix it. Now, a real mixer, I talk about this in episode 13, but a real mixer is going to do a better job. But when you don't have the proficiency skills or knowledge or time to do a proper super mix or the money, then E-Mastered is going to get you 80% of the way with 10% of the effort. And that's where this AI as a utility is really powerful.
You commented where it's like AI not really replacing the high skill level professional, but when the option is, I'm just not going to do anything because I don't have the money or resources or time to figure out how to do it myself, and I can't hire someone to do it. That's the gap where these like utility AI is going to fill and not replacing the craft professional who is a pro at this.
That's exactly right. And what you're talking about, this is the hot sticking point that creative people need to understand. They got to separate this battle in their mind. And you actually use the phrase gap. And what we call it is the skills gap principle. This idea that AI is not going to just unilaterally eliminate creative jobs. It's not that simple. When there is a skills gap, like for me, mixing, or a time gap for mixing, or a money gap for mixing, then AI can go in and fill that gap to some degree. And it's going to be better than nothing, right? And in some cases, it might be good. In a few cases, it might be excellent. Who knows, right? When I look at Evodo and Rimini together, the results I get are excellent. And I am not a photo retouching expert. But when I do those two together, you wouldn't know that. You wouldn't know that. I could do a pretty good job with those two. And my mixing, I'm a musician. I know how to record. I can write and play songs, but I'm not really good at the final mix. I don't know if it's, I can't hear those little differences. I don't know which order to put the filters in. I just don't have the discipline and I'm maybe not patient enough. But when I use E-Mastered, it warms the voice. It separates the layers. It makes it feel wider. And it just levels everything, and it comes back really great. So I use it for the YouTube show. We just get a premix. I mean, literally, the editor puts in the sound effects, music, and the dialogue, and she cuts and cuts and cuts. Andrea cuts all my stuff. And then I just send it to eMastered, and I get it back, and I get a little toast notification, it's done, and I put it in. And very rarely do I do anything else. Like, literally, I do nothing else. I get that, I tuck it in, I just keep going with whatever else I'm doing. And it sounds pretty good. Someone might say, oh, I could make it sound better. Good, fine. Are you going to do it for free for me? Because if not, it's a non-starter. It's not an option. And so it's like, this is fine. Now, if you're a professional sound mixer, the funny thing is like, oh, so you're trying to eliminate sound mixers. No, the professional sound mixers are going to mix the same way, but the professional sound mixers would do the same version of eMastered for color correction because they're not colorists. So they want the auto color because they love mixing. The colorists want the auto mixing because they love the color, right? And that's the skills gap principle. Move the AI into the slot that is not what you're great at, and it will elevate your project, and you might be able to increase the quality with limited resources.
With our NAB conversation, which was a highlight for me at NAB, and really enjoyed that conversation. It has stuck with me a long time since. But in that conversation too, you're definitely more gung-ho about generative AI. I think you said something like more images, more videos were going to be generated than shot. And that was one of the lines. And I know some people kind of got hung up on that.
The percentage of things that are photographed or recorded in the world for productions is going to go down.
But then in the Strata demo, you said, I think a generative is a little bit overhyped. And, you know, it's more about utility.
But the fact of the matter is, I think Gen AI is overhyped. There's purposes for it. And I'm a user. But really what the AI that I think is going to serve the creative community better is utility.
So I just want to know, where did 8 months in AI land is like a million years in real life world?
Yeah.
What shifted in your perception of like the generative tools and stuff?
I know exactly what you're talking about. And so what I was referring to at the very beginning of that conversation 8 months ago is basically the quality of the results. The quality of the results were going to hit a level that they could replace photography, right? Because they look real enough, they look proper enough, and everything in it is there. What I learned over time is that while they can make the quality look perfect and they can get the things that you're trying to get, they cannot repeat it. Large models are bad at repetition, and fine-tuned models might be able to repeat things, but they're not as good at being able to create the wider array of things. And so it's really interesting. That's what changed, is the consistency. And that's why when you watch companies that make generative tools, one of the things you got to really pay attention to, this isn't a criticism. It really isn't a criticism. It's sort of like reporting it's going to rain tomorrow. That's not a criticism. It's just bad news. It's just the news. I wish it didn't rain, but it's going to rain. Okay. So it's not a criticism. But when you watch these tools that make generative stuff, what they do is they make these amazing reels. They're like a show reel, a montage, right? Those montages are amazing. They're amazing. You're like, oh my gosh, photography, video, motion, all this stuff looks amazing. But if you really think about it, that's all it can make is a montage. That's all it can make. Because if you put two characters in a car driving down the Sunset Strip, and then you regenerate the next shot, it's a different car, it's different characters, the sun is now in the north instead of the west, and like all sorts of things are problematic, right? There's no continuity across that. And unfortunately, our minds pick up on that stuff. If somebody's jacket changes, we might not say his jacket changed. We might be like, what just happened? Like, we might not even know it consciously, but subconsciously, we're gonna be like, wait, what just happened? Or if somebody's eyes change, but the rest of their body's the same, we're like, what just happened? We pick up on that stuff, and it starts to break down our ability to suspend disbelief. And that's why continuity is important, because when the candles move, we're like, oh, the candles move, and then we lose suspension of disbelief. Yeah, well, if the person changes or the car is a different car, Cadillac became a Bentley, it's like, wait, that's not right, right? And that's what these models don't show when they do montages, because the montages don't have to worry about continuity. So when you're doing montage stuff or snippets or clips or stuff, this stuff is amazing. It's great. What we have to work on, which is going to take a long time, is to be able to stretch that continuity. Now they're starting to try to do that, where you can circle things and say, save this, keep this, but it is not at the level that creative people need to retain. It's certainly making a step towards that, but it's nowhere close. So when I think of replacing content, it's just going to take a long time before the continuity is totally in control. And this is what it's going to require. For Hollywood level productions to use generative AI to make something, you will have a production designer, a wardrobe person, hair and makeup. You'll have certainly a cinematographer. They will all be there, but they will be prompting the material to look the way they want it to. And it will be locked in and consistent, shot over shot, scene over scene, take over take. And that's a long way away, long way away. So it's not something encroaching on us right now, which is why in real life will still be the preferred way to create, but we can augment in real life with AI as a utility. I think that's the bridge where AI should be useful to the in real life community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, speeding up everything we're doing, speeding up our workflows, making us faster, better, more efficient.
And real quick, just like, you know, even mistakes, like we always have a C-stand in the shot, a boom mic in the shot. Those are problems. Now they're easy to fix with AI, right? A logo that shows up. If you're doing nonfiction, what do they do in nonfiction? They have someone do a logo pass. First, it's a lawyer, right? After the lawyer, they log it all. Then they need someone to go in and they got to track it all. Then what do? They blur it. AI can not only fix all that and remove this goofy kind of annoying blur floating around the shot, they can actually replace it with either no logo or a logo that is approved or your logo, right? Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden it gets better. And now there's no more blurring of something. There's actually control and it's actually working towards the content or the story intentionally. That's the type of stuff where AI in generative AI, rebuilding a shirt that has a soda logo and it's now going to be a different logo, like that is really helpful and practical. The lawyers are happy. The creatives are happy. If you get a partnership and you go to some company, say, hey, Pepsi, do you want to sponsor the show? We'll put a bunch of Pepsi logos in the show. Sure. Now there's a revenue opportunity there and it's going to look natural, right? These are opportunities I think are really, really cool. Plus, a friend of mine, a director pair, John Requa and Glenn Ficarra, they're like, it's always a struggle to get great audience in on location. And the best place to place the mic would be in the shot. Because that's like, put the mic right there because it'll sound the best. But it's like, well, then there's a mic right there. He's like, I just want to do a table scene at a restaurant, put the microphone on the table and just paint it out. and he's like, that's what I want. I don't want to like have the boom and have to like, people don't always want, you know, wired mics up their body and stuff like that. And so it's like, just put the thing on the table and just paint it out. Like that's the easy stuff. Also, if you're low budget, that's easy. Just put the mic on the table because then it sounds good and just paint it out. Like that stuff's going to be so awesome. And, you know, you just tell the actors, don't touch the mic. Okay, fine. And then it's fine. It's going to sound great and it'll look great later. And it'll be so easy to paint this stuff out. That's the type of stuff that I think this generative AI is going to be used for us, but not to just create the whole world, but to actually augment the in real life world to the way we want it to be.
Yeah, I feel like the first case is going to be these invisible effects where we just don't even realize that it was used or that it just changed something where we're not like, it's not calling attention out to itself. It's just making things look more natural, more realistic. It's funny that you mentioned the mic thing, though, because I feel like just as a aesthetic look, since the Rode mics came out, the clip-on ones, like I feel like that, everything with microphones has been like, we got to hide the mic. And then somehow, I mean, probably with YouTube and TikTok generation, it's like now become completely acceptable to just clip on the huge big pack on your shirt. And it's fine. I mean, it's as an aesthetic look, it's become a thing. I would say don't use that for narrative filmmaking, but it's just been an interesting observation where it's just like, no one
cares
anymore.
I've made that observation. I think it's funny too. I'm like, okay, I guess we're doing
this.
Through
great extents to hide labs and now you just clip the big box on your shirt.
Yep. Yeah.
Speaking of the mobile filmmaking space, you've done a handful of videos diving into in depth on the iPhone, iPhone 15 Pro, log, getting it to look more cinematic. What kind of prompted doing these deep dives into the iPhone, especially your most recent video when we're recording this, creating these depth maps to like really push the limit of like how you can adjust the depth of field and what the iPhone could do?
Well, at its core, democratization is always at my core. So I want to discover what people are doing. Plus, the creator economy has 50 million people in it, and that's expected to double to 100 million people. So there's so many people that need access to technology and techniques and workflows that it's just ever growing. And so this is an opportunity for me to experiment with what are the pain points? What are the opportunities? What are the ways to make things look and sound better? Because as more people are going to create content, which is good, we don't want to lower the bar of what that content looks like. And we don't want to make it harder for people to make it look and sound good. So there's opportunities. And one good thing about creative people, musicians are a good example. Musicians cannot help but go to Guitar Center and spend money. They love it, right? And filmmakers are the same. We love dropping money on gear. We can't help it.
You go to B&H, you go to Adorama. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, oh my gosh, I gotta spend money, right? And you go into these places, you're like, I can't believe how much I just spent, but you love it, right? So people like to buy gear, but there's so much gear out there. What is the best deal? What is the best fit for me? It gets kind of confusing and hairy. And so the iPhone, to me, is just a way to show if we can make an iPhone move upscale, then everything else, you have a place to orient. We need to have a bottom to have a top, right? And it's always funny because in the comments, people are like, why don't you just shoot on Alexa? I'm like, in all of some continents, there might only be 50 Alexas in all of Africa. I don't know. But there's probably 50 in the zip code that I'm in Los Angeles, right? So it's like, you got to think about accessibility. People don't have access to even like FS7s. People don't have access to those. So it's important for us, especially when we have the knowledge and experience and research and resources, we need to help other people understand what they can have access to. And I find people have a real hard time understanding that we're spoiled. If you have an Alexa or a Red or a Sony near you, you're lucky. And it's like, not everybody has that. So what can they have? And so I just want to push the iPhone because I like showing how far it can go. And Apple has certainly got some great talent working there that are trying to push the iPhone into the similar space. And the fact that it's even conceivable that you can compare it at all is incredible. And even though the people are nitpicking it and stuff, they've fallen for my trap because they're proving to me this is a product. This is an opportunity here. So if I could add AI depth of field as an automatic button to iPhone footage, I'm pretty sure after the last video I did, people would push that button and use it because it's like, yeah, that made the iPhone look better. If I shoot ProRes log, add a good LUT, and make some depth of field, it looks better. Then what do you want? That's it. Now, if you can afford an FS7 or an FX9 or a 1DC or a Venice or whatever, like then go for it. That's great. But if you can't, here's some available tools with some AI to make you at least a little bit closer.
For me watching it, it's been a bit of just like blurring the line of where is image acquisition, where is the camera, and where is the final image? Because even with the iPhone itself and the taking the photos and the portrait mode where it's doing all of this AI processing and machine and like identifying faces and stuff and processing it in camera and sort of extracting some of the steps and what you did in your last video of building this depth map where it is you're capturing in the camera, but then you're still doing some processing, which I imagine in the future that is like a step that Strata could come into play of like how you are handling the footage and then what you are doing with it afterwards. And even shooting on a Red or deburring, it's like you shoot raw and you still have to take these steps to make it something that you can do. And it's just sort of like this blurring line for myself of like where from like acquisition to like when you're actually done with it. Kind of seems to shift. And also pulling these tools, it reminds, you know, like going back to when DSLR started being able to shoot video in the 5D and then seeing features adapted into and other cameras because it was like, oh, okay, this could shoot video, but there are a lot of issues. Like there's no sound input. There's no, it overheats in like 2 seconds. You can only record for whatever the limit was at the time, 15 minutes. Technology from some of these lower tools, quotes, then being adapted into things that we might see 5-10 years from now in cameras. And I forgot which Sony model. It was a consumer camera, but even that had some AI features built into it, like face recognition and reframing the video based on identifying the face and cropping it so that the face stays in shot. I guess the question would be like, are you diving into the iPhone so much because like you feel like this is a hint at like where we're going to see how we capture images in higher end models like in the future?
I think the reason I'm fascinated by the iPhone is because I believe Apple is making intentional steps towards moving into a more professional cinema space, which would be an entirely new camera technology. And the reason I'm fascinated by it is because every time a camera company has moved into the camera space, it's always met with some resistance because like it's not good enough. It doesn't have this or it doesn't have that. Those are always true at the beginning, but they have to have people pioneer it through and make it work. Like I'm not going to do this, but right now, based on all my tests, I could probably start up a company that builds a cage. Inside the cage is a dongle that has the USB-C, and that USB-C gives you an HDMI, converts it to SDI. It also sends that USB-C to a hard drive, so a little SSD that you could pull out, right? And it also has a little bigger screen on it. And you could basically build a product that you just clamp the iPhone to, and it has all these features: wireless video, external video, hard drive, wireless lens focus. Like, it would be all there. That's so cool, because you just build that product and people would absolutely use it. I think it would be big in news and sports. Like, journalists would do that because they don't want to have to bring around more than they need. And this would be really powerful. So there's a lot of value here. I just find that using it and pushing it in the cinema sense is not, people never get this, but I don't push this technology in the cinema world to show that it would replace the cinema world. I have arguably the best cameras in the world and the best lenses in the world in my living room. I have access to that stuff. So I understand what, and if people look up my IMDb, I understand what it takes to make a high caliber Oscar nominated film. What I'm trying to show is, if you can stretch things all the way, it means it will relax into a nice spot for the average person. And that's what it's all about. Pushing things too far so that you find out the sweet spot. It's why most cars can go 130, 140 miles an hour. You need them to be able to do that so they can drive normally at 65, right? And so a lot of people don't realize that that's how all technology works. If you just make the highest performing element of it, the red needle bearing the needle, then it's not going to run very well in normal situations, right? The average situation. It also reminds me that the only way to make the iPhone look good is with a good crew. It makes perfect sense. But it's like, I need to have a gaffer. I have all these aperture and cream source lights, and you can't see all that. Well, kind of in the behind the scenes, you can see there's lights everywhere. There's no magic here. There's no like shortcut. You basically have a ProRes recorder. That's what an Alexa is, a ProRes recorder. And you got to have a bunch of lights, a bunch of stands, a bunch of good people, and a tripod and a slider. And Apple's just a ProRes recorder. It's a sensor. And that's actually how everything works. Everything works that way. And there's no magic here. But the fact that the sensor is good, the quality of the recording is good. And a tip, if you're going to try to use the iPhone, you got to really just use the 24 millimeter lens. On the iPhone 15, the 24 is the sweet spot. Once you go to the other lenses, it doesn't really have the same. It's very different. And I would say it's not as good. So the 24 is what I learned is like the sweet spot. Just stay on that. But of course, 24 has like infinite depth of field. So that's what the whole depth of field assignment was. It's like, can we automate with AI a way to simulate depth of field shallower? And we did. And it looks okay. It looks better than I expected. Some people would say, I can't even tell the difference. Okay, that's a win. And if it's even 20% better, well, that's a lot, right? And I would say it's at least 50% better. Plus a good colorist. Nick LaRoe is my colorist. You got to have a good colorist to make the stuff work. But ProRes 10-bit files on an iPhone and the 24 millimeter lens is amazing. Put some lights, put a good looking person in front of it, have a good colorist, tune it at the end. You'll blow your own mind. There's a lot of great YouTube videos of a lot of colorists doing that. And they're like, wow, this stuff looks really good. I'm impressed with my own footage. And that, I haven't had that feeling since like the Red One days, where I was like, wow. Or before that, the DVX 100 days. I was like, wow, I'm so excited by the footage I shot. I love that feeling. Who doesn't love that feeling, right? And so iPhone is just the craziest way to get that feeling and open up democratization in a way never before possible.
Yeah, and I think to what you said, it just highlights the importance of the shot on iPhone keynote that they did when they revealed that it was an iPhone. Just highlights more of the importance of lighting and crew and coloring and everything else around the device that has the sensor that you are filming with.
Yep. Someday, cameras will just become sensors. They just will. Someday, the entire system will just become a plate with a sensor and a lens collar. And that all that technology will just fit into a probably 21 millimeter thick system. And we'll just be shooting on sensors. It's not that hard to believe if you think about it, but that's where it's going to go. And so people need to realize that what Apple's doing is just an early version of that. And the GAC that you have to build around it will continue to be more and more wireless, require less and less stuff, become more and more concise. But talent and crew is always going to be required. No, there's no magic way to do that. Now, color correction in post is replacing some of that because you could do a lot more in color correction. So average lighting can look better with good color correction. That's true. That's been true for a while. But you can make good lighting exceptional with color correction, right? That should be nothing new, but the iPhone is now in a league where it gets to compete in that space. ProRes 10-bit log recording is the differentiator. If there's anything, it's like, well, what changed? ProRes log 10-bit recording to an external drive. That's what's new about iPhone 15 that is going to change the narrative. I think if Apple made a camera with an RF mount that was 20 to 30 millimeters thick and wasn't a phone, I think it would be a big hit.
Yeah, maybe after they launch the Vision Pro, that'll be their next product. So,
yep, maybe.
Well, I really appreciate the time. Do you want to run through real quick again? We've got the private beta launching, and then you have the NAB and IBC roadmap, and then where people can sign up.
Yeah, you could find us at strata.tech. You could sign up for the app. The private beta will come out February 1st, which this is the first time I've said that. So I'm so excited to share that. February 1st, it'll be a private beta. We need that feedback to grow from there to the public beta, to the version one. It's going to be a crazy 2024. But I'm so excited about trying to revolutionize workflow with the cloud.
And that is it for this episode. Thanks a lot for watching. And thanks to Michael for coming on and sharing a lot of insights on Strata and just how he's rethinking the future of workflows in post-production. If you enjoyed this episode, please give it a thumbs up, a like, subscribe to the channel, wherever you are listening to this. And once again, if you listened to this far, you will probably like the newsletter that we've got twice a week, VP Land, head to vp-land.com to subscribe or just check out the links in the show notes below. Thanks a lot for watching. I'll catch you in the next episode.